202-209-2950 to make that pledge of $100. You get the four charts as described. You get the two CDs, including the one on eye exercise and nutrition with Dr. Deborah Banker, and a CD with answering so many of these questions by John Monroe. But you also have, and you also have, the bonus event, which is a Natural Vision Improvement Zoom Q&A. And we're out of time for that. We're going to be going to Gary Null, so stay tuned.
Hi, I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. We're going to begin with the latest on health and healing, and we have a lot of new listeners from all over the world. And just so you know that I post all of my notes on the site. Go to prn.live, scroll down to where you see Gary's notes, and far more than what I can share in this given hour. And it all comes from peer-reviewed literature. Even when I'm challenging some of the establishment or corporate America's beliefs and that they're propagandizing, at least I have the scientific articles, the independent scientific articles, or at least from reporters and journalists who are not compromised. So you can have some trust in the quality of this scholarship. Compare that, for example, with the information you've been given from the mainstream media for the last 50 years. Simple. Take all the different stories on health and the environment and what we were told to do and what we are accepted to do in this task. Which side did you find the truth? And almost always you'll find it in the alternative perspectives. And that's why we begin with a simple study from the University of Cincinnati. And it's about something as simple as blueberries. Regular consumption of blueberries can reduce your risk of dementia. Researchers found, according to University of Cincinnati, adding blueberries, let's say a pint, to the daily diets of certain middle-aged populations can lower the chances of developing late-life dementia. The findings were published in the peer-reviewed journal Nutrients. And the researchers enrolled these patients and followed them. They were 50 to 65 years of age. They were overweight, pre-diabetic, and had noticed memory decline with aging. And that means they're going to be far more likely to have later life dementia and other common conditions. This study lasted just 12 weeks. And one group did not have the blueberries, the other group did. And then they measured. Everything else was the same. And what they found was those in the blueberry eating group improved in cognitive tasks depend upon what is called executive control. And they also had lower fasting insulin levels. That's good. Lower blood sugar. And that means that they had improved metabolic function and were able to more easily burn fat for energy. And the blueberry group also displayed an additional mild degree of high mitochondrial uncoupling, a cellular process that has been associated with greater longevity and reduced oxidative stress. And oxidative stress can lead to symptoms like fatigue and memory loss. So you see, on every level, blueberries made a difference. That's why it's considered a superfood. Now, wild blueberries are even more potent, and you can get them frozen when they're not in season. So just think of it this way. Blueberries are not expensive. They're non-toxic. There's no negative side effects. You can consume pretty much any reasonable amount you want. But having it on a regular basis is the key. But let's just say you can't get blueberries for whatever reason. Then buy yourself some blueberry concentrate, which is just very concentrated. They've taken the water out, so you're getting a lot. Even if you just put maybe 2 or 3 tablespoons into a smoothie, that's the equivalent of at least a pint of blueberries. Again, if we could do something to prevent a condition and then we can do 50 different things to prevent a condition. Wouldn't that make more sense to have a national Marshall Program on helping prevent mental decline, keeping our memory sharp longer, our cognition longer, keeping the brain from shrinking, which it will do, and then other things within the diet can help protect the neurons and the synaptics and the dendrites, even rebuild them. Yes, we can do that as well and have done that. In fact, that's something I know very well because Dr. Martin Feldman, a associate professor of neurology at Mount Sinai and one of America's leading neurologists, he and I were close personal friends for 45 years till we passed, and he oversaw what was the most important debrain aging study ever done. I mean, we reversed Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, all these myasthenia gravis, all these conditions that medicine is stumped, can't improve on. So we're not looking where a lot of the right answers are. Now, that's not to challenge what medicine does well and saves lives and works. Certainly, you're going to be doing your homework and see what works best. But they've left out completely all of the science that shows that shouldn't we be doing something that can prevent a condition, and if we do have a condition, can be used in a non-toxic way to help it. That's left out of all of the protocols and all of medicine today. Only the individual doctors are beginning to use this. Just want to share that. Now, from Yale University comes another good study, and this was published in the British Medical Journal today. Regular exercise with dietary advice linked to better mobility if you're a frail older person. Well, most older people are frail. They lose muscle mass, they end up with humpbacks and scoliosis, and they end up with osteoporosis. But Yale University is telling you a program of regular exercise along with expert dietary advice will reduce the mobility problems among those who are frail. Like power walking, it's aerobic. Also, you can engage in strength and flexibility and stretching and balance exercises and just have a good plant-based diet. And that was able to reduce mobility disability by 22% over 3 years. So, and the average age in the study was 79. So, and it only had people with physical fragility and sarcopenia, which is a combination of reduced physical function and low muscle mass. So, this involved 16 clinical sites in 11 European countries for 3 years, 2016 and 19. So you see, when we're saying that you can do something, you can get back your muscle mass, you can get your endurance, strength, and stamina, your mental clarity, it's not supposition, it's not hypothesis, it's good science. But what is missing? Think for a moment. What is missing from what I just told you? Profit. If it can't be patented, it's not going to be marketed. So why don't we have the Surgeon General and the U.S. Public Health Service and the National Institutes of Anti-Aging, why don't we have National Institutes of Aging, but why don't we have them, their spokespersons, coming forward and saying, every day we're going to just choose one channel to give information that is not a drug, it's not pharmaceutical-oriented, but it's functional. It functions in a good way in your body. That would make a big difference. And by the way, that would help a lot of people with comorbidities not to have those comorbidities. But it's not the first study from Yale. There's another study. And this study talks about the side effects emerging after approval of many of the U.S. drugs. And this is almost never, never brought up. The FDA just rubber stamps everything. They're fully captured because a lot of their budget comes from pharmaceutical companies, as does the CDC's. Here's what Yale University is saying. Almost one-third of new drugs approved by U.S. regulators over a decade ended up years later with warnings about unexpected, sometimes life-threatening side effects or complications. Now, that's from Yale, a highly respected university. That's from the scientists there. And the results covered all 222 prescription drugs approved by the USDA over the last 10 years. 71 were flagged drugs, including top sellers to treat depression, arthritis, infections, and blood clots. Safety issues included the risk of liver damage, cancer, even death. But when they were launched, oh, massive programs. Now, I went out to San Francisco to film a person who was one of the leading pharmaceutical sales representatives in the United States. Made a lot of money, had the big credit card. The company would lease any car they wanted. And because this person was doing their job. What is their job? Going into specialist office and first making themselves comfortable by their presence, by bringing in lunch for the whole staff, catered lunches. The cost of that lunch would probably be more than what the average person working in the office could have afforded. So that makes everyone feel, hey, we're getting some heat. Then they get used to it. And then special dinners for the doctor. And let's say the doctor's married. Then the couple go out and they go to the finest restaurant. Everything on the menu, from the finest wines and the entrees, all paid for. And then the person is invited to go to a conference at a luxurious resort, maybe in Hawaii. And they spend a week there, but only one day a week do they have to have a lecture on a particular type of drug. Now, of course, behind all this, the person sponsoring this continuing education seminar is a pharmaceutical company. Now, they don't blatantly say, get up there, mention our drug. They don't do that. But instead, the idea is you're using the drug. More often than not, whoever's paying the bills and whoever's sponsoring, you're going to use that drug. And then they get the biggest scientists or the biggest names in a given area, and they wine and dime them. But they go beyond that, because a lot of people wouldn't be moved that. Most big-time doctors, they make, you know, $1 million, $2 million a year. And with the average doctor, probably the net, after all expenses, somewhere between $400,000 to $1 million, depending upon specializations. Your neurosurgeons, your orthopedic surgeons, your heart surgeons, they make a lot more. Your oncologists make almost the most, because they can buy the chemotherapy in a lot of instances at cost and send it into the patient and get insurance coverage or out of pocket, and they can double the profit. Plus, on top of that, they charge for the regular services in the hospitals. Everything is billed. The patient may or may not succeed. But what happens if you're promoting a drug, like a good example, real example, for the millions, tens of millions of Americans suffering from arthritic pain, and you're given a drug from a company that did not have a good reputation for the safety of its drugs, and this particular drug ended up having side effects that they found in pre-market testing. But they didn't tell anyone. They hid it. And they hid the fact that you're more susceptible to strokes and heart attacks. And as a result, you don't know that. It's a COX-2 inhibitor. And this COX-2 inhibitor, which turns off pain in the body, and it works as far as turning off pain, but it's not safe. It's extremely dangerous. And then over a four-year period, at the low end, the very lowest end, 60,000 people died. But more realistic figures are that 500,000 people died, because a person may not die immediately, but what if they die a year later? No one's counting at that point. And a lot of the adverse reactions, including with vaccines, can take 1, 2, even 3 years before you see the ultimate effect. We're seeing that right now, for example, with pregnant women. Huge percentage increase in stillbirths and miscarriages, far more than what anyone anticipated, but they were never used in the study. Well, how can you say that something is safe and effective for a pregnant woman, and yet the pregnant women were excluded from the tests? The cancer patients excluded, heart disease patients excluded, dementia patients excluded, infection patients excluded. autoimmune patients excluded. So in effect, you've cherry-picked to make sure that the people in your study are very healthy, frequently very young. But now when it's approved, everybody with all those other medical conditions are taking the same amount of the same drug. One size fits all. That in and of itself is unscientific. But who's counting? And then someone dies. They say, well, it couldn't be. If they die within 2 weeks, it can't be the vaccine. Oh, yes, it can. And so all those people died early. No, it was the disease that killed them, not the vaccines. But what about the people that don't have any effects for 6 months, 9 months, a year, because they had enough of immune system to protect themselves? Now the immune system collapses. Now they got autoimmunity, and their immune system won't stop, and they literally start having organ failure. That's what we're seeing now. So you haven't seen the worst of what's going to be happening when you massively experiment on a whole population. You have to wait about 3 years. So we're going to be seeing that happen. That's what this is showing. That's what the FDA and the Yale study was showing. When 1/3 of all new drugs that were absolutely safe and effective and were promoted, and all the doctors started hearing all the sales pitch people who are not scientists, they're salespeople. All right? They're generally young, attractive, and have good backgrounds. So when someone comes from Harvard who's attractive, who's 26 years old, and they're saying, could you use the restocking your pharmacy? Now, not all doctors have a pharmacy in their office, but some do. Yeah, we could do that. And suddenly all your drugs are restocked on a regular basis. Well, that's just pure profit if you're not having to pay costs for a drug and you're able to sell it for retail and someone's restocking it for free. Wow. And we're supposed to believe that a doctor wouldn't be influenced by that? Yeah. So now you go to a big university because you got, let's say, you got a top heart specialist and you got a top neurologist and you got a top oncologist, and you decide to give each one of them and their departments $5 million for research. Okay, it's always for research. University's happy to get these endowments. And now, are they going to say anything against your drug? No. Who gets to do the studies? The university, supposedly, but who creates the protocols? The pharmaceutical company. Who gets to look at all the results? The pharmaceutical company. What if you did 10 studies and 9 of them failed to show improvement, actually show patients getting worse, and one study shows slight improvement? Which study do you think is going to be published in New England Journal of Medicine or some other publication? The one cherry-picked study that had some measure of improvement. What about all the bad ones? No one will ever see those. That's the power of the pharmaceutical company. That's how much capture they have. And then who's the big advertisers in the pharmaceutical journals? The doctors read, scientists read. The pharmaceutical company. How likely is a pharmaceutical company going to feel challenged by an ad on television that says the side effects could be death? No one. No one's going to stop the money from coming in. Everyone's got an excuse. But then you end up having to be told, gee whiz, we're sorry, but that drug that you took, well, there are side effects. So your stroke came from that side effect, or your cancer from having glyphosate in Roundup sprayed over your backyard. They've already settled, I think, 30,000 lawsuits, and they probably have another 50,000 to settle. But they're making billions of dollars. Bayer's the largest, you know, a drug company in Europe. It can afford it. And they bought Monsanto, and they bought all of Monsanto's problems. But they also bought Monsanto's genetic engineering of the majority of foods that we eat in the world. So you see this circle that you're in? Everybody who's powerful seems to be connected at one end or another. Where are you in that? You're the guinea pig. You're the lab rat. And so now the FDA is just, wow, they're just approving everything. So just understand, Yale University is telling you, big mistake on a lot of these. But we're not paying attention. Now from Harvard University comes a study that exercise during pregnancy is a good thing because it can yield metabolic benefits in grandchildren. If grandma like working out, her pain may be your gain. It may seemingly seem unlikely, but recent research out of the Joslin Diabetes Center says it is just the case. A professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School has found that a grandmother's exercise during pregnancy may make her grandchildren healthier metabolically, with less body fat, better insulin control, and in some, healthier bones. That's called EPA, E-P-I, genetic, G-E-N-E-T-I-C, alterations in the DNA, because epigenetic alterations can be changed as rapidly as two generations. So they analyzed the microRNAs, some methylation situations in the F1 generation eggs and sperm to see what's going on. And that's what they found. So what your parents and grandparents did, what they ate, if they exercised, how they behaved, how they expressed themselves, those are in your genes, for better or in sometimes worse. And finally, from the University of Southern Denmark and the University of Copenhagen, a new study finds that simply believing you can do something to improve it is linked with higher well-being. The power of positive thinking. Remember Dr. Norman Vincent Peale was the power of positive thinking? Well, he was right. So the number of people struggling with poor mental health and mental disorders has been rising around the world over the past few decades, and those who are struggling are increasingly facing difficulties assessing the kind of support they need, leaving many waiting months for help, even if they qualify for treatment. But in this recent study of 3,000 Danish adults, they found that those who believed and those who worked on the positive outcome, I can do it, it's going to get better, I'm going to create the discipline and get the tools I need and the support I need, but we're going to overcome this. Those are the people most likely to succeed. You're going to have a higher sense of well-being. The power of positive thinking. Now, the universe does not share an incomplete energy. Hence, anything like homeopathy that works based upon the laws of similars also works in reverse, meaning, I'll give you an example of this. I just counseled someone this morning, a very bright, successful, multidisciplinary person, the height of their game, a professional, and who ended up with a life-ending illness, stage 4, but said that at some point in all that crisis, the person said, I'm going to live. And every choice, every thought, every action from that point forward was to seek out the support systems necessary to save that person's life. They didn't do orthodox treatment. And today, that cancer is no longer stage 4. And that person has learned valuable lessons. This study is showing the same thing. And this is two separate universities, University of Copenhagen and University of Southern Denmark. Simply believing you can do something to improve it is linked with higher well-being. And sometimes that can mean saving a life. One last thing from McGill University, which is up in Quebec. Have you ever considered that working night shifts may, in the long run, have an impact on your health? Well, it does. A team at McGill University has discovered that genes regulating important biological processes are incapable of adapting to new sleeping and eating patterns, that most of them stay tuned to their daytime biological clock rhythms. So, simply stated, there's a negative effect on everyone from night shifts because of gene expression. The gene is not adapting to your new sleep patterns. You could be taking years off your life, depending upon how long you've worked night shifts and what kind of work you do. So you've got to overcompensate in other areas now once you know that. That's the latest on health and healing. We're 24 minutes into our program. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to an interesting part of our program today. Today is the Deep Thinking program. I've got a commentary coming at you, one that I hope that if you read and share with others, if you find, and only if you find it of value. But it's a something that most people are not thinking about. So what I'm trying to do is show you how self-evident different truths are, and more often than not, these truths are right in front of us. All we have to do is be open to them. But when we come back, we're going to first go to a person who is extremely credentialed in his field. He's a professor, a distinguished professor, University of California, Berkeley, published a lot on the field. In fact, he oversees a whole ethics and history section. So we're going to hear from him talking about where did this whole idea of whites throughout history being racist, and we've always had a divided culture. He says, not true. Not true at all. This would absolutely undermine all of D'Angelo's thoughts on white fragility and the whole movement of critical race theory. And he's also African American, but he's one of America's finest scholars and deepest thinkers. I think you'll appreciate what he has to say. Whether you agree or disagree, that's up to you. I'm merely providing a forum for challenging ideas. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. Before we go to him, I just want to let you know who he is. He is Professor John A. Powell. He is Director, Othering and Belonging Institute. He is the Robert Haas Chancellor Chair in Equity and Inclusion. He's Professor of Law, of African American and Ethnic Studies, University of California, Berkeley. He has postgraduate human rights fellowships, University of Minnesota, University of California, Berkeley, Juris Doctorate, Stanford University, background and degree in psychology and philosophy. Here he is.
But in terms of our early stages, whiteness, as we understand it, race, as we understand it, didn't exist. That may be hard to understand now because it's so prevalent. Everybody seems to have a race. But race actually came into being, and we can trace that being. And much of the formation of how we think about race came out of the New World, that is, when people came to the Americas from Europe. And there were people from Africa, and there were people from Europe, and there were the elites. And, of course, there were the people who were already here, the native people. And the elites tried to organize the people from Africa, the workers from Europe, indentured servants, and the native people to actually control them, to extract resources from them. And at some point, the people from Africa and the people from Europe were, decided to make common cause. They lived together. They worked together. They intermarried. They had children. It wasn't perfect, but there probably was much more what we would call interracial contact then than there is now. And it didn't seem odd at all. And at some point, it occurred to them that, look, we're doing all the work. We have no control over our lives. So there's this rebellion called the Bacon Rebellion, where they rebelled against the elite, and they demanded land, and they demanded greater democracy. They demanded a right to participate in the governance of the colony. And the elites rejected that. And there's this rebellion. And the rebellion was quite successful, called the Bacon Rebellion. The elites responded by saying, look, we have too many workers, and if they work together in a common cause, it's going to be hard to manage them. So they tried to experiment with separating the Africans and Europeans. And it took them almost 100 years. They tried religion. They tried language. They tried place of origin, and they stumbled upon race. Now, they couldn't start with race because race didn't exist, so they couldn't just think of it. They had to experiment, and they start passing new laws like anti-miscegenation laws, and they told the now newly minted whites that your role is to identify with the elites. You're not an elite yourself, but you should identify with the elites, and you should police the non-whites, and they create slave patrols. But also, they created a new identity, white identity. It had not existed before. And the white identity was that middle stratum, that stratum of identifying with the elites and controlling the non-whites. whites. And it's important when, in terms of saying this, that the elites didn't think of themselves as white. Yes, they were Europeans. What they thought of themselves were the elites. And because there had been this history where whites were so close to what was then blacks, there's always a fear that you might fall back into that space. So there's always this anxiety. An early definition of whites were defined in terms of not being black. It was a negative definition. Interesting, the Bacon Rebellion, Bacon himself was white, but it became known as a rebellion driven by blacks because they were trying to create a sense of blackness being scary and somehow a threat to whiteness. What's important in terms of this history is that whiteness itself never was the top dog. There was always the elites. So when we look at understanding race today in the economy, we sometimes think in terms of whites and non-whites, or whites and blacks, Latinos, others. And it has some currency, that's real. But missing from that formulation are the role of the elites. And the colonies, Virginia being the most important, was a corporation. So Virginia was literally owned by a corporation and governed by a corporation for the crown to extract as much resources as possible from people, from land. And to some extent, that formulation we still live with today, even though it's been updated.
Interesting, isn't it? Again, someone who has studied the history carefully, one of the most knowledgeable people in America on the subject, and lays out a different perspective. Again, whether you agree or disagree, on this forum, we follow the mandate of Pacifica's originally founding father, and that was Lew Hill. He said, be a voice for the voiceless. And today, we're only allowing one type of voice, the official voice, any forms at all. And that's not good. Now we've got a voice that I'm not happy with. I would disagree with everything he is saying. What I do appreciate, however, is that he is telling us the truth. At a large conference recently, this is Dr. Yuval Noah Harari, H-A-R-A-R-I. He is probably the most recent spokesperson for the World Economic Forum and its agenda. He's a professor of history, but not in any of the hard sciences, but he is 100% bought into artificial intelligence, transhumanism. They've eliminated all the, in one whole area, they've eliminated all the ATM machines because they're going to a digital currency. They're already starting this. And right after he was elected, the president of France, Macron, he is now suggesting that they have a different system of governance in all of Europe, and he wants to bring in the European Union. And this is in alliance with, and he, by the way, with the World Economic Forums and Davos Group, of which he is one. He was one of the New World leaders, and he was groomed by the head of the World Economic Forum. By the way, tomorrow I'm going to do a commentary. I don't have time today on who is Klaus Schwab? And he did not start this himself. I'm going to give you the whole background on who really, and boy, will the liberals be concerned, or should be, true liberals, when I mention the name Henry Kissinger, because he was one behind it all. We have it all documented, but that's in a commentary for tomorrow. Now let's hear what is in store for you. Mind you, they will not make this all over the world from Prince Charles and Trudeau and Barack Obama and Joe Biden, Bill Clinton. They would never be saying these things about a new world order and a great reset, a great opportunity, use the crisis as an opportunity to start over, as if it's something good. But they don't give the details. Here to a group of sycophants, look around the audience. It's a huge audience. And these are the people who are on board. These are the people who are coming from industries, media, government. These are the so-called best and brightest. These are the intellectual technocrats. Amoral and up for this. And this is where everything in the world is going. everything. So I'm just giving you a heads up now to what he calls the future being human, ?
Let me just have 1 minute to get friends with this computer and make sure everything is okay. And can I have a bit more light on the audience so I can see the faces and not just speak to a darkness? Thank you. So I want to talk to you today about the future of our species and really the future of life. We are probably one of the last generations of Homo sapiens. Within a century or two, Earth will be dominated by entities that are more different from us than we are different from Neanderthals or from chimpanzees. Because in the coming generations, we will learn how to engineer bodies and brains and minds. These will be the main products of the economy, of the 21st century economy. Not textiles and vehicles and weapons, but bodies and brains and minds. Now, how exactly will the future masters of the planet look like? This will be decided by the people who own the data. Those who control the data control the future, not just of humanity, but the future of life itself. Because today, data is the most important asset in the world. In ancient times, land was the most important asset. And if too much land became concentrated in too few hands, humanity split into aristocrats and commoners. Then in the modern age, in the last two centuries, machinery replaced land as the most important asset. And if too many of the machines became concentrated in too few hands, humanity split into classes, into capitalists and proletariats. Now data is replacing machinery as the most important asset. And if too much of the data becomes concentrated in too few hands, humanity will split not into classes. It will split into species, into different species. Now, why is data so important? It's important because we've reached the point when we can hack not just computers, we can hack human beings and other organisms. There is a lot of talk these days about hacking computers and email accounts and bank accounts and mobile phones, but actually we are gaining the ability to hack human beings. Now, what do you need in order to hack a human being? You need two things. You need a lot of computing power, and you need a lot of data, especially biometric data. Not data about what I buy or where I go, but data about what is happening inside my body and inside my brain. Until today, nobody had the necessary computing power and the necessary data to hack humanity. Even if the Soviet KGB or the Spanish Inquisition followed you around everywhere, 24 hours a day, watching everything you do, listening to everything you say, still, they didn't have the computing power and the biological knowledge necessary to make sense of what was happening inside your body and brain and to understand how you feel and what you think and what you want. But this is now changing because of two simultaneous revolutions. On the one hand, advances in computer science, and especially the rise of machine learning and AI, are giving us the necessary computing power. And at the same time, advances in biology, and especially in brain science, are giving us the necessary understanding, biological understanding. You can really summarize 150 years of biological research since Charles Darwin in three words: organisms are algorithms. This is the big insight of the modern life sciences, that organisms, whether viruses or bananas or humans, they are really just biochemical algorithms. And we are learning how to decipher these algorithms. Now, when the two revolutions merge, when the infotech revolution merges with the biotech revolution, what you get is the ability to hack human beings. And maybe the most important invention for the merger of infotech and biotech is the biometric sensor that translates biochemical processes in the body, in the brain, into electronic signals that a computer can store and analyze. And once you have enough such biometric information and enough computing power, you can create algorithms that know me better than I know myself. And humans really don't know themselves very well. This is why algorithms have a real chance of getting to know ourselves better. We don't really know ourselves. To give an example, when I was 21, I finally realized that I was gay after living for several years in denial. And this is not exceptional. A lot of gay men live in denial for many years. They don't know something very important about themselves. Now imagine the situation in 10 or 20 years when an algorithm can tell any teenager exactly where he or she is on the gay-straight spectrum, and even how malleable this position is. The algorithm tracks your eye movements, your blood pressure, your brain activity, and tells you who you are. Now, maybe you personally wouldn't like to make use of such an algorithm, but maybe you find yourself in some boring birthday party of somebody from your class at school, and one of your friends has this wonderful idea that I've just heard about this cool new algorithm that tells you your sexual orientation, and wouldn't it be a lot of fun if everybody just takes turns testing themselves on this algorithm as everybody else is watching and commenting? What would you do? Would you just walk away? And even if you walk away, and even if you keep hiding from your classmates or from yourself, you will not be able to hide from Amazon and Alibaba and the secret police. As you surf the internet, as you watch videos or check your social feed, the algorithms will be monitoring your eye movements, your blood pressure, your brain activity, and they will know. They could tell Coca-Cola that if you want to sell this person some fuzzy, sugary drink, don't use the advertisement with the shirtless girl. Use the advertisement with the shirtless guy. You wouldn't even know that this was happening, but they will know, and this information will be worth billions. Once we have algorithms that can understand me better than I understand myself, they could predict my desires, manipulate my emotions, and even take decisions on my behalf. And if we are not careful, the outcome might be the rise of digital dictatorships. In the 20th century, democracy generally outperformed dictatorship because democracy was better at processing data and making decisions. We are used to thinking about democracy and dictatorship in ethical or political terms. But actually, these are two different methods to process information. Democracy processes information in a distributed way. It distributes the information and the power to make decisions between many institutions and individuals. Dictatorship, on the other hand, concentrates all the information and power in one place. Now, given the technological conditions of the 20th century, distributed data processing worked better than centralized data processing. which is one of the main reasons why democracy outperformed dictatorship, and why, for example, the US economy outperformed the Soviet economy. But this is true only under the unique technological conditions of the 20th century. In the 21st century, new technological revolutions, especially AI and machine learning, might swing the pendulum in the opposite direction. They might make centralized data processing far more efficient than distributed data processing. And if democracy cannot adapt to these new conditions, then humans will come to live under the rule of digital dictatorships. And already at present, we are seeing the formation of more and more sophisticated surveillance regimes throughout the world, not just by authoritarian regimes, but also by democratic governments. The US, for example, is building a global surveillance system, while my home country of Israel is trying to build a total surveillance regime in the West Bank. But control of data might enable human elites to do something even more radical than just build digital dictatorships. By hacking organisms, elites may gain the power to re-engineer the future of life itself. Because once you can hack something, you can usually also engineer it. And if indeed we succeed in hacking and engineering life, this will be not just the greatest revolution in the history of humanity. This will be the greatest revolution in biology since the very beginning of life 4 billion years ago.
How clear could he be? Part two tomorrow. You heard what he says. Isn't it interesting? He said that Israel is working on, he's connected to everyone there, that a 100% digital state in the West Bank. Well, think about what that means to people living in the West Bank under the current conditions. Now imagine they will have every single movement, every word, everything written, everything everywhere monitored. Not for the rest of Israel. And yet, let that slip by as if it's nothing. And they said, if we can hack an organ, well, they're already able to hack organs. And they have a whole new G6 coming, and that is going to be able to get into the electrodes in a person's brain, which is being developed as we speak. They've even been testing. Just want to let you know, they're not hiding anything from you. And this is the same person who called the average person useless and worthless for the future. Only the elites will have the advantages. No one else will. And tomorrow we'll get into the segment on how you own nothing. But who will own it? Someone has to own it. Yeah, the elites will. You won't. That's here now. I mentioned just what is happening in Australia, taking out the ATM because they're shifting over to, taking over to a digital currency. Once they have the digital currency, they control you, everything. And he'll talk about how the digital currency will allow the corporate interest to see what you're buying and accept or reject it, how much you can buy, what you can buy, what you can spend money on, all that they will control. I'm just looking at the downside. By the way, the drug I was didn't mention, but some people may have wondered, what drug are you talking about that, you know, was given to millions of people and that killed so many? Vioxx, Merck's drug, same Merck. Now to a commentary, and I'm going to go straight to top of the hour, so BI will sign off when it comes to their news. This I'm entitling, Escaping America's Sinking Ship. Why? For the past 5 decades, I've been a consumer and social activist, an investigative journalist, producing, writing, and directing more than 100 important documentaries, doing one of the nation's longest-running non-commercial radio programs. And over the years, I've organized and led dozens of demonstrations to expose the crimes of corporate and government interest. I'd always believed that taking the initiative to bring the public awareness the faults and failures in our nation would engineer constructive change. However, increasingly over the years, I'm looking honestly at the fact that very few of us have ever caused any constructive change. And I wished it were otherwise, but little has changed to reverse the acceleration of our entire civilization's decline. Deep reflection and introspection consistently raises an essential series of questions. What has gone wrong? For example, after promoting the benefits of adopting a healthy plant-based diet for half a century, hundreds of articles in the peer-reviewed journal, none supporting the traditional diet we eat, none supporting a meat-based, fat-based diet, all supporting a plant-based diet. I now question whether even 5% of the population has embraced a healthy, vegan, plant-based diet. The U.S. is the most morbidly fat or obese country in the world per population. Our life expectancy has lessened by many. Many children born today will not outlive their parents. We are a nation with widespread inequality and buried in colossal debt at every level of society. We thrive on debt. If we're the elite, we are put under by the debt emotionally and financially if we're not. Even the professional class, who are highly educated, find themselves in a precarious debt situation at every level. With new recession and uncertainties, an actual inflationary rate around 15%, when the economy was growing, the emerging elite embarked on a mad spending spree that they believed was necessary to maintain an unrealistic standard of living. Everybody wanted more. Now, with the pandemic and Biden's sanctions against Russia backfiring, millions in the professional class are unable to service the debt. Whatever they make, they spend. I found that true even amongst the people I know, who at one time would have been more reasonable. Now, if they make $100,000, they spend $100,000, or if they make $1 million, they spend $1 million. We're not saving. We're not saying no to these unnecessary and almost uncontrollable impulses to buy stuff. And that is the problem. All of our governments, federal, state, and city, have been on a massive spending binge as well. The White House is dumping $30 billion into the war in Ukraine, now up another $10 billion, now a $13 billion. How high will it go? Easily $100 billion or more. And it's going to a completely corrupt regime. None will go to the poor and suffering people of the country who've been the victims of the crisis they're in now. And yet none of these government expenditures have benefited either the country or its citizens. Anywhere in the world. As a nation, we are both economically and morally bankrupt. Nor is anything crucial and necessary being done to reverse global warming trends. Just look for a moment at the power, at the privilege that Greta Thunberg had. I do not know a person in my lifetime that had as much positive press, met as many world leaders, spoke before congresses all over the world, and got less done for it. It helped her career and her parents' career and all the other sycophants that were parasitically involved in that movement, but nothing has changed because of it. You can yell and scream and cry. Your family are actors. Easy to learn that. But what actually changed? And the answer is nothing has changed. The Trump administration signed cruel orders to destroy the remaining ecological fragility that we all depend upon. In fact, four of the world's most polluted nations, Brazil, China, India, and the United States, have witnessed an increase in greenhouse gas emissions during lockdowns. Although politicians readily raise their concerns about the environment and human life, their actions are just the opposite. To the contrary, Marx's 19th century warning about infinite capitalist growth goes unheeded. Grow the economy in the name of progress by depleting whatever natural resources are available in order to prevent the gross domestic product from falling. That's a prescription for disaster. Where are the wiser minds? As a result, for decades, the warnings of many conscientious environmentalists, economists, and scientists are unfolding at a more rapid pace. the planet has entered feedback loops that are not able to be slowed.
From WPFW in Washington and WBAI in New York, I'm Sue Goodwin. Here are some headlines. President Biden today will push state and local leaders to use unspent money from last year's $1.9 trillion COVID relief package to hire more cops and fund crime prevention programs. In remarks from the Rose Garden later today, the president is also expected to announce that $10 billion from the American Rescue Plan has already been committed to police departments and public safety across the U.S. Biden's announcement comes as some Republicans are trying to tie the president to the Defund the Police movement, which has been embraced by some Democratic members of Congress. The movement intends to reallocate money from police departments to other social and public safety programs. Biden has consistently reiterated his belief in investing in police departments and that he is against defunding the police. The Select Committee investigating the January 6 attack on the Capitol issued subpoenas to five high-profile Republican members of Congress, signaling an escalation of their probe. Among those subpoenaed was top House GOP official Kevin McCarthy. New audio has revealed that in the days following the insurrection, the minority leader had considered asking then-President Trump to resign. The panel wants to understand how McCarthy's initial criticisms of Trump changed to support and whether Trump pressured him to change his tone when the pair met in late January 2021. The other four subpoenaed representatives are Jim Jordan, Mo Brooks, Andy Biggs, and Scott Perry, all of whom voted to reject the results of the 2020 presidential election. In related news, federal prosecutors have launched a grand jury investigation into whether a trove of classified White House documents that wound up in Mar-a-Lago were tampered with. The New York Times reported on Thursday, citing two people briefed on the matter. The National Archives discovered in January that former President Trump took boxes of official documents to Palm Beach upon leaving the White House. Some of those boxes were clearly labeled as classified, raising questions about whether Trump may have violated the Presidential Records Act. The lawyer for Brittany Griner said today that the WNBA star's pre-trial detention in Russia has been extended by another month. He also said the court had denied his appeal to have Ms. Griner transferred to house arrest. Griner, a two-time Olympic gold medalist, has been held in custody in Russia since mid-February on drug charges that can carry up to 10 years in prison. The charge is based on allegations that she had vape cartridges containing hashish oil in her luggage. The State Department last week said it now regards Griner as wrongfully detained, a change in classification that suggests the U.S. government will be more active in trying to secure her release. This comes after the U.S. and Russia engaged in a prisoner swap last month in which ex-Marine Trevor Reed was exchanged for a Russian pilot jailed for drug smuggling. And a Louisiana state law that had proposed classifying abortion as homicide was withdrawn from debate by its sponsor yesterday after fellow lawmakers voted to amend the bill. State Representative Danny McCormick pulled the plug on his Abolition of Abortion in Louisiana Act after the state house voted 65-26 to make several amendments, including removing language that would allow abortion procedure patients to be charged with murder. Democratic Governor John Bel Edwards, who is anti-abortion, called the bill radical and patently unconstitutional and not a pro-life bill. Some state Republican lawmakers offered similar rebukes, calling it unconstitutional and unnecessary. Louisiana already has laws in place that would automatically ban abortions if the Roe v. Wade Supreme Court decision is overturned. And in weather today, in Washington, D.C., it is 68 degrees and cloudy. In New York City, 62 degrees and cloudy. From WPFW in Washington and WBAI in New York, I'm Sue Goodwin.
Stay tuned for Leonard Lopate at Large here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org online.